Hey everyone, welcome to Recovery Rocks. This episode is sponsored by the folks at Sour Humanoid Vinegar.
And Sour
when I say the folks, I mean my partner who just started this amazing vinegar brand. Sour Humanoid is designed for cooking, created by a New York City sommelier who got sober after working at Michelin-starred restaurants and curating award-winning wine lists. This vinegar is an excellent way to make any meal special with very little effort. Check out some of the easy recipes at sourhumanoid.com. And we've had Nick on an episode before. He's, you know, a fellow sober entrepreneur, and we're excited to have Sour Humanoid sponsor this episode.
It's an amazing story, and I will give a brief testimonial just because I don't cook, but I have sent Sour Humanoid gift packs as gifts over the holidays to a couple of my friends who are big cooks, and it got rave reviews. So user tested, customer tested. And all thumbs up.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Recovery Rocks. I am with my fabulous BFF, Lisa.
Lisa.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. I miss you. I'm excited. I get to see you soon.
I know. I'm so excited.
I'm also excited because we have one of my dear friends and fellow debut author joining us today. Her name is Gina Maffa, LCSW. She is a grief and trauma therapist. And her new book is called Moving On Doesn't Mean Letting Go, A Modern Guide to Navigating Loss. And I know this is grief is a heavy subject, but we are going to discuss grief today. We're going to discuss, you know, the grief that like obvious grief of like, you know, of loss. But there's also this grief when we get sober or reevaluate our relationship with alcohol of this, you know, grief of our former lives. So we're going to talk about all of that. But we can't do that without Gina. Gina, welcome. Thank you for hanging with us today.
Hello, sweet friends. I'm so happy to be here with you both. Thank you so much for having me.
I am very lucky, you guys. I'm interviewing Gina for the second day in a row.
Sooner than, I think, 12 hours apart. 12 hours apart.
Yes. So just real quick, friend of the pod, Katie Mack, you guys have heard her. She's been on probably three times now, Lisa. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, that's right.
Love her.
Mack, she was on a few weeks ago talking about her show, Ugly Cry, about grief in the modern age of social media. And the show's closing this week, but if that conversation interests you at all, definitely check out, that episode with Mack. After the show last night, we did a talk back where I interviewed both Gina and Mack about grief. And here we are 12 hours later doing it again, but we're going to talk about some different stuff this time.
I love it. I'm here for it. I loved it. I loved every minute of it. So
it was a good time. And I think it just shows that, you know, there's so many different ways to explore grief in recovery. You know, Mac is a fellow sober, creative person. And, you know, she wrote a one woman show about grief and you wrote a book about grief. So, Gina, I'm wondering, can you tell us why you decided to write this book about grief?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of different reasons that all somehow came together. But, you know, I lost my mom in 2016 and to cancer. And I was feeling so powerless about it. You know, here I am, a grief therapist. I was with her every step of the way during her cancer journey, which was very short because she was misdiagnosed twice. And so I felt that sense of trauma in it, in her loss in a way, right? So I wanted to do something with it. And I felt a lot of pressure to find meaning, but it didn't feel authentic. It felt selfish. And so I sort of tabled that. And, you know, being a grief therapist and working in trauma and grief, the pandemic came. And I was getting a lot of people, kind of an influx of people from all over the country who were feeling helpless, who really didn't understand what they were experiencing, had either lost people, relationships, jobs, you know, livelihood, you know, a sense of safety, just an overall sense of there's a loss that I don't understand. And so, and I'm here with two hands and not, you know, 12-hour days that I was working nonstop. And I remember being in my practice and people were saying, do you have books for us then? If you can't see me twice a week, can you refer me some books or recommend some books? And so I would recommend the books that I knew or the books that I thought were semi-helpful for me when my mom died, but they weren't hitting the young people that I was working with. And one of my clients one day was like, Gina, but everything you explained to me, I really get, and it helps me. Could you just write the book? So
just write the book. Just real quick.
Just write a book. Yeah.
It was so funny because it, you know, because I don't know if it's just being a woman or what it is, but imposter syndrome came flying in and I was like, me, why would I write the book? You know? And then one day I was like, but wait, I've been a therapist 19 years. Why wouldn't it be me? I've been doing this work. I'm in the trenches every day. I see this day in and day out. Like, why wouldn't it be me? And then so that started the journey. But I really felt like it was the right time because it was an offering. It wasn't something that was about me necessarily anymore. And so I felt like I could give it to people who either didn't have access to grief therapy or any kind of specialized, you know, grief work, or who didn't understand it, or who maybe had a bad therapeutic experience, which a lot of people do, or maybe people who just are at the front lines of therapy trying to figure out if it's right or not, but wanting to do that inner work. And so once it felt like an authentic offering I can give and it would be a part of a conversation for people, it was the right thing to do. And so that's the long story of kind of why and when I wrote it. And then I could really dedicate it to my mom too. So it felt like this double pronged blessing in some way.
I'm sure it was cathartic too.
Yeah.
It was, you know, and I also had a sudden loss in my practice of a client who died of natural causes very, very suddenly, a young client. And so there was a lot of very real in-moment grieving that then brought up the grief of my mother. So it was as close to being with me in a broken, open heart as one could get, really.
Well, like you said, you've been in this line of work for nearly two decades, and you are the person to write this book. And it shows, because this book is so great. It's so helpful. Even if you're not grieving a loved one, you know, like I read this book. I was in this place of like, I want to wait to read Gina's book until I need it. And then a friend of mine, one of our many mutual friends, Gina and I, when we met on Instagram, we realized that we had lots of mutual friends, and not just acquaintances, people we actually, like, very important people to us, which is how I knew that you were amazing. But one of our mutual friends was like, well, maybe now is the perfect time to read Gina's book because you can have a different experience reading it. And I'm glad that I took their advice. So I'm wondering if you have any insight on that, and maybe we could talk about like these other forms of grief that you go into, maybe disenfranchised grief. And also like, I love when you talk about like grieving missed opportunities, our former lives, you know, like when we get sober, there's this huge amount of grief that I don't think many people acknowledge. And I know I threw like four questions at you, so
you
pick
did.
One.
I'm going to find a way to like put all of those country roads together.
Thank you.
But I'm really glad that you read it when you did. And I actually think that's amazing advice. So whatever beautiful mutual friend told you that, thank you. And it's kind of the same thing I say with people seeking therapy, right? It's people come to therapy when there's a crisis or when things are really hard. And for me, I'm like, come when things are really good so that we could actually dive into things that maybe have felt painful or hard. And we have the space to do it because you're not in a survival place, you know, of just being in crisis. So we actually have time to process things and look at patterns and plan ahead and look at life, you know? And so in this way, it's sort of exciting to me that people might read it and not be in the midst of a really deep or, you know, excruciating grief experience, because in it is a lot of learning and there's a lot of teaching in here. So like you were talking about, I really want to pinpoint that there's so much more to grieve, and we have grieved so much more than we think we have, right? The nuance of grief is something that really evades us in so many ways. I would say that from childhood, you've grieved probably more than double of the things you think you have. And, you know, in sobriety itself, you know, even the idea of, wow, when I was under the influence of this or that, I wasn't me. And my relationships with X, Y, and Z, you know, my parents or my friends or whatever, what I can actually mourn that too, because I wasn't my true self. And so the relationship is not what it could have ever been. You know, when it's parents, it's sort of like, wow, I'm grieving all of those years that I wasn't okay and never really had the authentic relationship I could have had with them. Or even just, you know, those parts of ourselves that we couldn't be honest with. We can grieve that, the trauma that we didn't give the time of day, that feeling of disconnection that we never gave comfort to, that all that's all we were seeking. And so I think that in those nuanced ways, we're always grieving. And but looking at it in terms of our behavior, instead of really what's at the crux of it, which is like a spiritual injury.
I like that. I mean, yeah. I don't like it, but I like that.
That hit me too. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, it is, right? But it is, right?
It
because
is.
Grief is not science, it's mystery. And so to me, it's a deep spiritual injury. And we don't know that because we are, you know, in this capitalistic society where everything is about productivity and, you know, and getting over things quickly and, you know, bless their hearts, but coaches are everywhere because everybody is so excited to have very quick fixes.
Yeah.
And that's not how it works when, especially with something that's as deeply spiritual as this is.
I remember when I first quit drinking. Or I guess it wasn't when I first quit drinking, but maybe I'd had some time under my belt and there's this idea of like, I need to catch up for all those lost years. And I felt like I wasted 15 years of my life getting fucked up. And I think that's connected to my work addiction where I'm trying to make up for lost time.
Oh my God. I mean, that's everywhere, right? But it's sort of like, but then that's exactly where your work lies. That's where your spiritual work lies because we're never really going to get that time back. We're going to get a new time. And so there's only how I show up now is actually what my offering is, right? Because all of that stuff was your learning and your hiding and your numbing and you're trying to cope. And so there's none of that. And so sort of looking at it as I've got to grab that back can sometimes actually thrust you back into an addictive type of way of being in the world.
Which it does. You said, to like speaking to like this, how capitalism is really the driving force to so many of our professional decisions right now. And that is a big part of it I didn't let myself grieve those years, you know? And I just am like, okay, I'm sober now. Time to work really hard and play catch up to all these other people that have been, you know, in the industry as long as I have. Like, I started my journalism career at 30, which puts me, quote, behind, you know? and a lot of the editors that I work with are like 25. So, you know, it's an interesting.
And who ends up on the cover of a magazine?
I mean,
you know, but no, I see where you're saying, and I'm asking you to gently and lovingly reframe that for yourself, because at the end of the day, it's just a continuation of the anxiety and the survival mechanisms that you were trying to sort of get away from before. And so I would sort of almost look for a new visual to create, right? Of starting afresh on a clean slate with all of the things that you now have before you as tools and blessings and gifts that are from this work and coming at it with this new sense of, I don't want to say balance because that's such an overused word, but a sense of being almost like an eagle, right? Like above all of it and being able to see ahead and with where you are now and behind you, which is a much wiser place to be coming from. And also a place that has more of a sense of peace to it because there's a knowing that where you've been. And so, and a trust in now all of the things you've gathered from there. It's like gathering your bones. you know, and they're stronger now. And so coming from this place that's so much stronger is new. And I almost want that to just be the energy surrounding that for you. And for anybody else listening who may be starting something new and feeling like they want to catch up. Because that's a common feeling.
I love that kind of idea, because the thing I was thinking is, you know, I always, when I was, you know, drunk, I always wanted to be a writer, like from when I was a kid. And I would still say through the whole time I was drunk. And then when I got sober, I wrote a book. And, you know, a lot of the time I would go back and beat myself up and be like, if only you had had your shit together earlier, like you could have had this career. And the answer is like, maybe, nope. Maybe, but good chance not, because I had to go through all those things in order to bring me to where I needed to be and end up being, you know, writing the book that maybe I didn't think I would ever write, but that I needed to write. That was like the right thing for me at the end of all that.
Yeah, no, exactly that. And the offering that you give has so much more richness to it, right? Because of who you've now become in these moments that have made you who you are now. And so I think it's always about the offering in some way, right? Because we can write and we can give and we can do, but it's when we look at it as like a serving and an offering, it levels the playing field out, because we're not looking to fix people. We're literally looking to offer something that is really the most authentic we have now at this time. And so I think that's really beautiful.
And your use of the word war really struck me, because like I'd never thought of it like that, but like I never thought of my those 15 years like that, you know, like it really, I fucking survived, you know, like I didn't have the tools, you know. Now I have words like trauma and anxiety and yoga and meditation and therapy. Like I didn't have any of that. And even if it was presented to me, I don't think I would have wanted it. I was sick, you know, I was really sick. Like you said, I was full on in survival mode. And now, you know, that I'm almost 8 years in recovery, I am giving myself a little bit, I'm learning to give myself more of that grace that you're talking about, and accepting, like, I kind of look at those 15 years of like, oh, well, that's like, that was my research. I was just paying for my research. Now I can write about this stuff.
Yes.
Well, but that's really what it is. It's not wasting your time. It's gathering evidence.
Yes.
Empirical data. Now you have it. And yeah, I mean, that's a really good way of looking at it, you know, because it's true, actually. And I really do believe, I mean, that we put out into the world the thing that is meant to be at the right time. And I don't mean that in any kind of, I don't even mean that spiritually, but I do mean that in terms of all of the things that we put in our bags and carry with us, and what we choose to do with them, and how we choose to create this alchemy with them, which is what you both have offered. And, you know, and hopefully me too, by turning pain into service, you know, which you both have done. And that's all we can ever hope for, no matter what we endure at some point, is to be healed enough, or at least on the path to healing enough, that we can offer something and turn it into something beautiful for others too.
I feel like I've been hogging this conversation. Lisa, do you have any questions for Gina?
Yeah, I mean, you first of all, you've not been hogging it. I've been like eating up every word of it. But yeah, I mean, I think like the idea for me, and in, you know, thinking about our conversations, like one of the things that you noted, that I noted about your book, was that like, you can grieve sort of lost opportunities and things like this, that what we're talking about. And that sort of grieving is part of us, no matter what we're doing, what we're up to. There's always kind of some level of something, you know. And I think about when, you know, there was never time. I also, you know, I lost my mother last year, and at the end of last year, and it was, you know, so much of it was like I was able to be there and show up, because I was sober, for many years at that point. But I thought about all those things. Like, it just, it can bring like this kind of, it brought back in a way so much shame for me around, now I'm going to get all emotional, so much shame for me around like, God, look at her and look at like, there's some purity in that, you know, circumstance when you're going through the end of someone's life with them, someone you love. And I'm just thinking, you know, all that old shame that I thought I had gotten through about having lied, having not showed up, all the years that I was just like lying straight to her face and, you know, and full of shit. And I sort of relived that again. And I was wondering what might you have to say? Because a lot of our listeners too might not have put down the drink before they lost someone extremely close to them. And sometimes I, you know, worry about that idea that it sound, when I talk about having been able to be there for my mother, that I almost feel bad because I know so many people are not or were not able to be there for their parents. And what would you say to them? So, because I think part of the grieving process is learning how to forgive yourself.
It really is. And it's also looking at things in a way that is more objective, right? Because we can get so easily stuck in our shame and in our guilt. And that is more times than not, if you really think about it, the people who love us just want to love us. And yes, do they want to see us healthy? Yes, of course they do. But their love never ends. So the love, you know, more times than not, the love is always there. There may be all of the things in the mix, which is sadness or disappointment and fear, you know, but the love is always there. And I think if there's one thing we can hold on to, it's that one thread of how do I remember that I am still loved through all of my sickness and through all of my, the depth of my despair and desperation, that it is still there. You know, I work with a lot of people that are in a similar place, and I know it sounds really lame, but to me, the letter writing activity of this can be incredibly powerful. All the things that you would say both to yourself as somebody who was not sober during that time, both from you, but also from your loved one, you know, and even if it is not sobriety and or substance use of any kind, I mean, I can, even just sharing with you, there were times in my own life with my relationship with my mother where I was just, I wouldn't give her what she wanted. And, it, you know, I wouldn't give her the closeness that she craved sometimes. And while I was sitting next to her on her deathbed, I had all of those regrets and all of that shame come up of like, why couldn't I just give her what she wanted, you know, all of these years. And it's not too much different, you know, than and right. than any other circumstance. And so the forgiveness, though, within there is that she loved me no matter what I gave her. And she yes. loved me no matter who I was. But that is still a weight to carry around. And I do think that there's so much, and I talk about it in my book, is sort of like the letter writing to me feels really, really powerful when we're ready to do it and when it feels authentic. In terms of forgiveness, because I think so much comes out on the page that we don't know will come out on the page while we're writing it. And so it really can, it sounds really lame, but when I'm doing it with clients, they're like, I didn't want to do it. But now that I've done it, this is so life-changing. Like, look at this letter. I didn't know I was going to say these things or write these things, and what a release it was. I've got, you know, 10 pages here where I just feel like I've unloaded something that I've been carrying for a decade. And so I just think it's worth, I think guilt and shame live, and both of them live in our bodies. And I think that a lot of the time we have to figure out ways to get them out. And also at the same time, sort of remember that there's fact and fiction in our narratives that we carry around, and sort of how to untangle the two when we're getting stuck ruminating about shame and guilt. So that's my long answer.
That's really so real. And it's... And I want to give a caveat to that only because people listening might be like, well, these three women are writers. Of course, they're going to suggest a writing exercise. This is not a writing exercise. This is this is only for you, maybe your therapist. But when you just let yourself just release, either through the written word, like pen and paper, or open up a Google Doc and just have at it, it really can be a cathartic experience. And don't worry about editing. Don't worry about spelling. Just like, yeah. just get words out of your head. And like Gina said, these feelings are living in our bodies. Get them out and get, and just putting them somewhere else can be really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Please don't look at beautiful language.
Yeah,
it that's not matter. What it's like, about.
Even like my professional writing, if you saw the very first draft of it, it is very unattractive. There's so many spelling errors and it's, you know, whatever. Before we go into our music minute, I do want to give Gina the opportunity to combat some misinformation. Because when people hear about grief, the first thing that they think of is the five stages of grief. And I would love for Gina, if you could chat about that a little bit, and then we'll talk about some music.
Yeah, sure. First, I don't want to throw shade. I think Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is an outstanding, brilliant woman. And she brought so much to people who were terminally ill. The five stages of grief were developed by her. And she created them for people who were in the process of dying. And so there were five stages because there was an end time at some point for people who were, you know, terminally ill. I think it was an amazing starting off point for grievers in a time in our history where there was absolutely no information on how to get through grief at all outside of Freud, you know, basically saying that the path forward was disconnection. And so I think that it was really important to have this structure for people. However, as time has gone on and humans are, as we are, complex and, you know, always monkey minds jumping from one fear and thought to another, it was important to really expand on that. There is no such thing as five stages of grief for a griever. If you are somebody enduring loss, it is nonlinear. It is incredibly messy. You will cycle through a spectrum of emotions and physical experiences, maybe on a daily basis, maybe on an hourly basis. It will also feel like you're getting through a period of time and you have a great week. And then perhaps a week later or a year later, it will come upon you, a grief sensation or a grief quake. And you will feel as if you are maybe back at square one or maybe grieving for the first time. It feels that intense. And I just want to stress this. You are okay. You are not failing at grief. You are not stuck at grief. If you can't seem to get through something for a week or a month at a time, there is a diagnosis of prolonged grief disorder, which is incredibly controversial in our mental health community, because it does give a time frame of grief, which I completely disagree with. But what I think is important is that grief is getting the attention, money, and research that it deserves. Mm. And so I am happy about that. But I think what happens is that it puts people back into a place of fearing that they're doing something wrong if they don't feel totally better in a year. And
like
so
they need to check all these boxes. And that's the last thing you need to worry about when you're feeling such immense pain.
Yeah. And I just think it's really important to know that, you know, you are going to experience this throughout your body. It will cycle all the time. And anniversaries will be hard potentially. Maybe one year will be okay and the next year will be mysteriously painful. And that it's just important to know that that's really normal and to give yourself permission to grieve for as long as you need to in the ways that need to come out for you. Hopefully they're not in a numbing, self-medicating, self-destructive way. So I do put that caveat on it, but it's okay to even binge Netflix if you need to, just for distraction from time to time. But I really just want to, you know, part of what I write in my book is a lot of permission slips, because there's so much pressure on people to do things quickly, to do them cleanly, to do them within a period of time that doesn't really put too much of a burden on both your work and or your friendships or people around you. And I think it really feeds into the grief illiteracy that we have as a society. And, you know, for people who, you know, it's the one thing people are all experiencing at some point in their lives, death or non-death, you know, related losses. And so I just really feel like we have to be incredibly gentle with the emotions that come up. It's not just sadness. It's okay to rage. It's okay to take a broom and beat your bed. And it's okay to be a splayed chicken on the floor weeping, you know, for an entire day. It's okay to eat all the cheese puffs if you need to for one, you know, for an hour. It's just okay. You know, I just want people to know that, yeah, we'll take them. Cheez-Its is sort of my thing right now. That's how I got through writing my book, Cheez-Its. But I revisited a seventh grade favorite. But yeah, I mean, I just think the five stages of grief can be really misleading for people while they're grieving. And it can really make people feel stuck and more anxious and more depressed because they feel like they're doing it wrong. So if you are hearing this, you are not grieving wrong. There's no way to do that.
And I'll just wrap up real quick. It's everything you just said, Lisa and I could say about sobriety. You know, it's like people think I'm not doing it right. My sobriety doesn't look like this person's. Don't compare your relationship to alcohol with someone else's relationship with alcohol, and don't compare your grief to someone else's grief, right?
Yes. Please,
So real quick, we only have like a minute, but I want to know, Gina, are there any songs that you're listening to right now? Any songs that maybe helped you get through writing this book or grief or whatever? Anything you want to talk about? Music.
Music. So I want to look at something because for me, I have such a strange little palette. But one of the things I remember listening to, I'm all over it from, you know, Adagio for strings to Claire de Lune to, you know, I don't even know. I'm looking at it now. I think I was even listening to Dean Lewis. But I think one of the songs that continues to be for me is Joni Mitchell, Both Sides Now. Mm. It's something that I listen to every time I need to remember and come back to myself that there's, you know, we can look at love from both sides now, right? From give and take. And so, and I think that sort of the same for sobriety, the same for loss, the same for trauma, that we get the experience to look at our lives from all of these different angles and vantage points and all of the things we get to learn along the way as a gift and grieve them too. But there's something about that song in particular that I continue to come back to year after year after year. I mean, I'm a huge Joni fan, so I don't know if I'll ever get out of my Joni era.
That's okay. Or you can stay there.
No need to. Yeah.
I know. So yeah, I mean, I think whatever people can listen to that can open a portal to something deeper. Mm. Music is the biggest, I mean, for me, it's one of the biggest healing tools. And I use it a lot in my work too. So I had kind of a sad music playlist because that's how I get into being able to access these things. I it's hard to write about grief and be happy. And yeah. So I had to really actually kind of almost like acting, right? You have to like, when you're acting, you have to like go into the persona. And I had to actually take that journey back deep into my dark soul of the night in a lot of ways to remember those emotions and be with my clients in that place. So thanks, Joni, for
shout
that.
Shout out to Joni if she's listening.
Yes.
Gina, thank you so much. This was such a beautiful conversation. You talk about grief in such an approachable way. And thank you so much. Can you just remind listeners what the book is called and where they can find you? This will all be in show notes, but just so their ears can have it too.
Sure. And thank you both so much for this. Moving on doesn't mean letting go is the name of my book, A Modern Guide to Navigating Loss. It really will help you through every part of your loss, including navigating the outside world. So thank you for highlighting it here. And you can find it anywhere books are sold. I love getting to say that.
Yay.
Anywhere
Yay,
books are
that's
sold.
Great.
I love that. And Gina, thank you so much for hanging out with us. And
thank you.
There's also an audiobook for listeners. If you're like, this sounds like a good book, but I don't want to sit down and read. There's an audiobook, and you can clearly hear how wonderful Gina's voice is. It's a soothing, as soothing education about grief as possible. So
it was made for audio.
I cherish you. She's a dramatic read.
We love the drama. Gina, thank you so much for hanging out with us today, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you,
I adore
Gina.
You. I adore you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We hope you like what you heard. If so, please hit subscribe and consider rating and reviewing us so others can find us. Tawny, how can our listeners find you?
You can find me at Tawny M. Lara on all of the social medias. And you can find my blog, Sobriety Party, sobrietyparty.com. Lisa, how can we find you and your amazing book?
My book is Girl Walks Out of a Bar, and it is available at bookstores everywhere and online. And you can find me at lisasmithadvisory.com. And I'm on social media at Girl Walks Out. Thanks for listening.